Heavy Pop.
CKUT. Yo. Yo, this is for your mind, soul, and spirit. Plus your body vibes. Masters at work, you gotta hear it. And West Indian rhythms on Saturday night. Roots, rock, reggae, I keep it tight. Manchild, hitting switches, keep it right. Decipher on a Friday. Psalms of soul, I do it my way. With ill groove on Sunday, I gotta say one way. We stick together. It's for unity in the community on CKUT at 90.3. Manchild and John Fish. We give you that musical wish to put more music in that dish. So listen to your radio.
Welcome to Equilibrium on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is your host, Ryan Young. We want to dive right into what we're going to play today on the show, which is a talk by Robert Lustig. And Robert Lustig is an endocrinologist. He is Professor Emeritus of Pediatrics at the Division of Endocrinology at the University of California in San Francisco. And he specializes in the field of neuroendocrinology with an emphasis on the regulation of energy balance by the central nervous system. His research and clinical practice has focused on childhood obesity and diabetes, and he holds a bachelor's in science from MIT, a doctorate in medicine from Cornell University, and a master's of studies in law from UC Hastings College of the Law. He's been featured in documentaries like Sugar Coated and Fed Up, and is really a crusader against the processed food industry, especially the use of sugar in the processed food industry. And he gave a talk recently at George Brown College in Toronto at their Center for Hospitality and Culinary Arts at an event called Ambition Nutrition in 2017. The talk is quite long, but very interesting, and so we're going to jump right to it now.
I said last night at the speaker's dinner, food is medicine, which means that chefs are doctors. And if you look at it that way, hopefully everyone will come on board. You are not what you eat. You are what you do with what you eat. And what you do with what you eat ultimately determines whether or not you get sick or not. And that's what we're going to focus on today. So, the title of this talk is Processed Food, an Experiment That Failed. Now, how many in the room have ever done science? You probably then know that 9 out of every 10 experiments are failures. Now, when you have a failure, what do? You have to determine, was it the hypothesis that was wrong? Or was it the procedure that was wrong? Or was it the interpretation that was wrong? And you have to go back and rethink it. So imagine that everyone in this room, all of us, have actually been unwitting research subjects in a grand experiment of 50 years duration, posed by 10 principal investigators situated around the world, who all posed the following hypothesis. Processed food is better than real food. How would you determine if that experiment was a success or a failure? Well, you have to look at the outcome variables. And for this experiment, those outcome variables are the following: consumption, health and disease, the environment, and finally, cash flow. And cash flow has 3 parts: to companies, to consumers, and to society. And we will deal with each of these in turn. Everybody understand the format of the talk? So here's how the experiment started. And I will tell you, I ate a lot of those Swanson TV dinners. Okay? Salisbury steak was my favorite. Yeah, you remember that one, do you? Well, unfortunately, this is what it looks like today, and all you have to do is walk through, you know, the aisle at any supermarket, and all of this is very well known to you. And here are your 10 principal investigators there in the center, and you have heard of every single one of these. In fact, if you've heard of a food, it is one of these 10 companies, which control 90% of the food around the world. So first we have to define, what do we mean by processed food? And Joanna Blythman, a nutrition critic from, a food critic from UK, published this book called Swallow This, and this is the definition of processed food. It has to be mass produced, has to be consistent batch to batch. It has to be consistent country to country so that the experience is the same wherever you go. It is specialized ingredients from specialized companies. Virtually all the macronutrients have to be pre-frozen in order to be able to withstand long flights and shipping. That means the fiber has to be removed, and that's an extraordinarily important point because you can't freeze fiber. Prove it to you. Go home tonight, take an orange, put it in your freezer, take it out in the morning, put it on the counter, let it thaw, try to eat it, see what you get. You get mush, right? Why do you get mush? Because the ice crystals macerate the cell wall, allow all the water to rush in. Hey, food industry knows that. So squeeze it and freeze it, lasts forever. Can sell it forever. It becomes a commodity. That's the definition of commodity, is storable food. And when we went from food to commodity, that's where things changed, for just that reason. Okay. It has to stay emulsified so that when you put the lasagna in the microwave, the fat and the water don't separate out under the heat. And it has to have a long shelf life or freezer life. Otherwise, depreciation's too high, costs go up, and then you've got a problem. Everybody with me so far? So that's the food engineering definition of processed food. But there's a nutritional definition of processed food as well. Three things too little, eight things too much. We're going to take them in turn. Not enough fiber. Now, fiber is what you throw in the garbage after you juice the drink. Right? No. Fiber is actually the reason to eat the fruit in the first place. And the reason is because what fiber does is it forms a gel on the inside of your intestine, the soluble and insoluble fiber, and you need both. And of course, fruit has both. Forms a gel, and that forms a secondary barrier that prevents early absorption in the duodenum so that all of the calories don't reach your liver. And we're going to talk a lot about the liver today. And if you don't absorb them early, what happens? Number one, your blood glucose doesn't spike as high, therefore your blood insulin doesn't spike as high, which is important metabolically to keep yourself in yin-yang energy balance. And it also means that you're not going to absorb them early, which means they're going to go further down the intestine to the next part called the jejunum. And what's in the jejunum? The bacteria. Now, the bacteria are not in the duodenum because the pH just changed. But they are in the jejunum. That's called the microbiome. You've all heard that term, I'm sure, now. It's a hot term in medicine. So when you consume food with fiber, in other words, real food, you're feeding your bacteria. You're not feeding you, you're feeding your bacteria. And that's a good thing. So not enough fiber. Not enough omega-3 fatty acids. So these are heart healthy, anti-inflammatory, anti-Alzheimer's. Well, where do you get omega-3s from? Fish, right? Salmon. Okay, but what kind of salmon? Wild salmon or farmed salmon? Turns out, wild salmon. Because wild salmon do not make omega-3s. Wild salmon eat omega-3s. Well, what made the omega-3s? The algae. The salmon eat the algae, we eat the salmon. That's how we get them. We get them third hand. But if you're eating farmed salmon, you might as well eat a steak. Micronutrients. So, vitamins, minerals, various other cofactors for metabolism, like biotin, etc. You know, these are usually found in the fiber fraction. For instance, vitamin B1, thiamine, the first disease that was known to be a nutritional deficiency disease, beriberi, occurred in the Chinese when they started polishing rice because the thiamine was in the fiber fraction. And we learned that, and that's how we discovered the existence of vitamins. So when you remove the fiber, you remove a lot of the micronutrients. And then finally, eight things too much. Too many trans fats. Now, trans fats are the devil incarnate. Trans fats are the single most dangerous consumable you can put in your body. Cyanide is a little more dangerous, but trans fats are next. Why? All right, the reason trans fats were put into the food is because bacteria can't digest them. because they don't have the enzyme to cleave the double bond, the trans double bond, because normal fatty acids are cis, not trans. So the bacteria would try to chew them up into two carbon fragments, and then they'd reach the trans double bond, and they'd stop. So they couldn't grow on it, so that things that were made with trans fats could not go rancid. Witness the 10-year-old Twinkie. Well, guess what? Our mitochondria in our cells are refurbished bacteria. We don't have that enzyme either. So when we consume trans fats, same thing happens. You reach the trans double bond, that's it. And then they line your arteries and livers and cause heart disease, liver disease, and many other of the chronic metabolic diseases we know today. Now, in 2013, our FDA finally, after 25 years of basically screaming and jumping up and down and practically sitting on them, finally agreed that trans fats were not generally recognized as safe, and they are now being removed from the diet. Hooray. Finally, a nutritional win. Took a long time. Branched-chain amino acids, leucine, isoleucine, and valine. These are three essential amino acids. You have to eat them. You can't make them. They are the primary components of muscle. So bodybuilders consume protein powder, which is virtually all branched-chain amino acids. And if you're building muscle, that's a good thing to do. But what if you're not building muscle? What if you're a mere mortal like me? And you take in too many branched-chain amino acids? There's no place else to store them except muscle. So what happens to them? They go to the liver. The liver takes the amino group off. They become alpha keto acids, enter the Krebs cycle, overwhelm the Krebs cycle, and the mitochondria have no choice but to take the excess, throw them off, and they get turned into liver fat. And we're going to talk again about liver fat at great length in just a few minutes. So that's one of the ways that meat could cause disease, because of the excess branched-chain amino acids. And so which kind of meat has that? Corn-fed beef, chicken, and fish. Grass-fed, not so much. That's important, too. Changes the composition of what you're eating. Omega-6 fatty acids. So these are pro-inflammatory. You need them, or you will be eaten by the maggots. But you don't need so many of them. If you have a lot of them, you tend to induce a pro-inflammatory state, because omega-6s are the precursors to a compound called arachidonic acid, which then leads to prostaglandins, which are a primary inflammatory mediator. Food additives of all sorts, red food dye number this, yellow food dye number that, et cetera, et cetera. I don't have to go into all those for you. Emulsifiers, this is one of my favorite. So, like I said, you need the emulsifiers to keep the microwave lasagna from separating out. Well, what are emulsifiers? They're detergents. They keep fat and water together. That's why you add the Tide to your laundry. Well, what happens if you add the Tide to your intestine? Think about it. There is a mucin layer that coats all the intestinal epithelial cells. That gets eaten away, and there are electron microscopy studies that show the bacterial apposition onto the intestinal epithelial cells, and that has been associated with various autoimmune phenomena in the gut and possibly even food allergy. The fact that mucin layer gets destroyed. So what are some emulsifiers? Polysorbate 80, carboxymethylcellulose, and my favorite, perhaps yours too, carrageenan. Everybody heard of carrageenan? Okay, so where do you find carrageenan? In ice cream, okay? That's what keeps the fat and the water together in the ice cream. And who introduced carrageenan to ice cream? Margaret Thatcher. She was an ice cream chemist before she was an MP. She truly was the Iron Lady. Salt. Now, salt is complicated because 15 to 20% of the American, I would assume Canadian population as well, are exquisitely salt sensitive. And currently we are consuming triple our appropriate allotted consumption of salt. We should be consuming 2.3 grams of sodium. We are getting 6.9 grams of sodium. Now, 80% of us can excrete the extra sodium without significant upset because our kidneys are working fine. But that 15 to 20%, they need their salt to come down. And the problem is it ain't coming down. Okay, Campbell's soup, try to remove some of the salt from their special request soups, landed flat on their face. Ain't doing that again. So the question is, should salt come down if it's only for 15 to 20%? That's a public health versus clinical medicine question, which we're going to leave for another day. Nitrates. So that's what's in cured beef, sausage, bacon, etc. Okay. Nitrates form nitrosoureas in the intestine, which have been shown to be directly causative to colon cancer. And finally, the number 11, the big kahuna, the one that blows all the other 10 out of the water, sugar. And between Gary and me, we're going to tell you a lot about sugar today. So, you all know this is true. When did you learn this? Did you learn it recently? In fact, we've been saying this since 1950. But when did somebody do something about it? 1994. 44 years of knowing something and not doing anything about it. This is from Paul van der Velpen, who is the head of Amsterdam's health service. Okay, and he says that sugar is addictive and the most dangerous drug of the times. In fact, we all know this. And here's why we know this. Anybody know what this is? Anybody ever work in a newborn nursery? This is called Sweeties. Sweeties. It is a super concentrated sucrose solution that you dip the pacifier in and stick in the normal newborn boy's mouth before the circumcision. The Jews have wine, the rest of the world has Sweeties. Because they do the same thing. They activate your own endogenous opioids because they are addictive. And of the 600,000 food items that are currently available in the American food supply, 74% of them are spiked with added sugar for the food industry's purposes, not for yours. Conversely, of a study that where 400 packaged items were looked at for salt, only 50% of them had greater than the recommendation for added salt. That means that sugar is the marker for processed food. Okay? Because if there's sugar in a food, God put it there. But if there's added sugar in a food, a company put it there. Everybody got it? So that's the marker. So now let's do our four outcome variables. Consumption. So over here on the left, we have the original White Castle hamburger, 1957, 210 calories. In the middle, we have Bob's Big Boy at 618 calories. And in America, in the midst of the obesity epidemic, Hardee's had the temerity to offer us the thick burger at 1,420 calories. And in California, we are so lucky that we have the Carl's Jr. $6 burger, 2,000 calories. That's the entire caloric allotment for the day, right? And they're proud of it, okay? They do commercials about that fact, okay? Basically, like, stick it to the man, you know, if you know what I mean, okay? So, are calories up? Absolutely. We are all eating more, no question. 187 calories per day for adult men, 335 calories per day extra for adult women, 275 calories more per day for teen boys. Yes, we are all eating more. The question is, what are we eating more of? Is it fat? Nope, not fat. Only 5 grams, 45 calories. Basically, the fat's a wash. Here's the secular trends in specific food intake over time. And you can see whole milk way down, meat and dairy about the same, cheese is up slightly, milk desserts up slightly. Bottom line, it's a wash. And that's what the data say. It's a wash. We are not eating more fat. In fact, as our percent of calories from fat have gone down because of the USDA, the AHA, the AMA, and every other medical organization who told us to reduce our consumption of fat to try to prevent heart disease. We did it. We went from 40 to 30%. And as we did it, our obesity and metabolic syndrome prevalence have gone through the roof. Because it ain't the fat. Never was. It's the carbohydrate. 228 calories in this in the teen boys. And here are the carbohydrates here in red, all through the roof. Why? Because carbohydrates are commodities. You can sell them. And in particular, one we know of well, beverages, right? 41% increase in soft drinks, 35% increase in fruit drinks, fruit aids, etc. What is this stuff? Well, here in North America, it is this stuff, high fructose corn syrup. You have it here in Canada, too. Okay, 63 pounds per person. But you know what? The rest of the world doesn't have so much of this. Very limited exposure in Europe. Japan has it because it was invented there. But the rest of the Pacific Rim, no high fructose corn syrup. None in Australia, none in Korea, none in China. And you know what? They got more diabetes than we do. How is that possible? Because it's not the high fructose corn syrup per se. High fructose corn syrup is evil, no question. But it's no more evil than sucrose. But it is cheaper because we grow it at home. And we don't have to import it. And there's no tariffs on it. So what are we talking about? Well, here's the composition. High fructose corn syrup on top, sucrose on the bottom. Notice, high fructose corn syrup, one glucose on the left, six-membered ring, one fructose, five-membered ring on the right. You'll notice they are not the same. Six-membered ring, five-membered ring. So food industry says all sugars are the same. Patently not true, because the picture says so. Now look down below at sucrose. One six-membered ring, one five-membered ring, O-glycosidic linkage linking the two. The enzyme sucrase in your intestine cleaves this in about a nanosecond. You absorb the two molecules equally. Bottom line, it's a wash. They're the same. High fructose corn syrup, sucrose, they're the same. But because high fructose corn syrup entered in 1975, it provided competition for sugar. It made sugar cheaper. And then everyone could afford to put more in, especially as we went low fat. Everybody got that? Okay. So I call this slide very specifically the Coca-Cola conspiracy, and I mean it, and you'll see why. Over there, 1915, the original bottle out of Atlanta, first one being sold nationally, 6.5 ounces. If you drank one of those every day for a year, that would be worth 8 pounds of fat per year. Then 1955, the next size up after sugar became plentiful after World War II's rationing, 10 ounces, first ones found in vending machines. Okay, that would be worth 13 pounds of fat. Then came the ever ubiquitous 12-ounce can in 1960. That's worth 16 pounds of fat. And over there is the single unit of measure in America today, the 20-ounce. Okay, now, anybody know how many servings are supposed to be in that bottle? 2.5 8-ounce servings. Anybody know anybody who gets 2.5 8-ounce servings out of that? That's a single serving. Okay? That's worth 26 pounds of fat. And then in the middle, we have the 7-Eleven Big K Thirst Buster, Big Gulp, whatever you want to call it, 44 ounces. That's worth 57 pounds of fat per year. So you'd say, well, QED, we're done. Here you go, right here. That's the problem. Not so fast. There's more. Way more. So if you look at what's happened to our sugar consumption, our ancestors getting fruits and vegetables out of the ground in like the 1800s and the occasional honey got about 4 pounds of sugar per day. We peaked at around 110, 120 pounds of sugar per day. We have gone down slightly because of the obesity epidemic. We've reduced by about 10%. But you can see what's gone on. You can see where processed food entered the sphere. Okay? Everybody with me so far? So consumption, way up. No argument. All right. Time for the next variable, health and disease. So this is from the New England Journal of Medicine a couple of years ago. And what we're looking at are things that are preventable that contribute to health and disease. And what you'll notice is smoking, down. Blood pressure, down. Cholesterol, down. Activity, up. We should be reaping a health benefit, but we are not. If anything, we have a health deficit. And why is that? Because obesity is up and diabetes is through the roof. It's quadrupled since the 1970s. Diabetes used to be a disease of over 65 people, and now it is a disease of 8-year-olds. And in America, we're going to knock all those diabetics off the rolls. This is the head of management and budget, Nick Mulvaney, saying specifically that we're taking diabetics off the rolls because we can't afford them. So here's the problem. In America, at least, I don't know if you had it here in Canada, probably during a Blue Jays game, you probably saw this commercial for Coca-Cola in 2013 called Coming Together. Okay, it's a two-minute video, and this is a direct quote from that video. Beating obesity will take action by all of us based on one simple common sense fact. All calories count, no matter where they come from, including Coca-Cola and everything else with calories. So according to them, you can get your calories from carrots, or you can get your calories from cheesecake, or you can get your calories from Coca-Cola, or you can get your calories from kumquats. Doesn't matter. If you eat more than you burn, you will gain weight. If you eat less than you burn, you will lose weight. Therefore, it's about energy balance. Therefore, it is about calories in, calories out. Therefore, it is about diet and exercise. Therefore, it is about two behaviors. Therefore, if you're fat, it's your fault. Therefore, any calorie can be part of a balanced diet. Therefore, don't pick on our calories. Go pick on somebody else's calories. All of those mantras, which you have heard from everyone, including your government, are based on this premise that a calorie is a calorie. And after all, it's common sense. Well, I don't believe in common sense. I believe in science. I believe in data. And what the data say is something completely different. What the data say is that some calories cause disease more than others because different calories are metabolized differently in the body because a calorie is not a calorie. You are not what you eat. You are what you do with what you eat. And in order to understand that, you have to understand some science. It's called nutritional biochemistry. So, how many of you in here are dietitians? You learned about counting calories. Day one. I am here to tell you that you can throw that away now. Because if you count calories, you are part of the problem, not part of the solution. And I mean that very specifically. And I will hunt you down. And here's why. Back in the 1970s, we had a little war going on in nutrition. Not like we don't have one now, but we had one then. There were these two guys at the top of the two camps, if you will. And this guy over here on the right, named John Yudkin, British physiologist, nutritionist, biochemist, was the first one to say, you know what, sugar is a problem. Sugar's the bad guy in this story. And he had a lot of correlative data. And he wrote this book in 1972 called Pure, White, and Deadly, where he basically figured it. But it was all correlative data, because that's all he had. On the other side, on the left, we have this other guy named Ansel Keys. Everybody heard of him? The K-ration during World War II? So, you know, he had a name already. And of course, he was from Minnesota, so he had to be telling the truth. My wife tells me that all the time. She's from Minnesota. Okay. And he's the one who said saturated fat was the bad guy. And they two had a war. But let's look at Keyes' data, since it's all about the data. So here are his seven countries. U.S., Canada, there you are. Australia, England and Wales, Italy, Japan. Coronary heart disease on the y-axis, calories from fat on the x-axis. Looks pretty good. Correlation, right? Except for one thing. It wasn't the seven-country study. It was the 22-country study. Those seven were cherry-picked, because here are all 22. Now, there's still some sort of relation, but it's not nearly as tight, is it? And he left out the outliers. The Maasai, the Inuit, the Rendille, the Tokelau tribes, they eat blood and meat and milk. There's not a carbohydrate to be found in their diet. And they have the lowest incidence of heart disease on the planet. Well, how do you explain that if it's about saturated fat? In fact, this report from Credit Suisse came out last year, September 2016, called Fat, the New Health Paradigm. And this is their decision. I had no input to this whatsoever. A high intake of omega-6 fats, vegetable oils, has not been proven as beneficial for our health, and trans fats have been shown to have negative health effects. The higher intake of vegetable oils and the increase in carbohydrate consumption in the last 30 to 40 years are the two leading factors behind the high rates of obesity and metabolic syndrome in the United States. Saturated and monounsaturated fats are not. Okay? They looked at the science themselves, not influenced by any corporation, and came up with this determination. A bank did this. Okay? And now we have the smoking gun, and I'll show you to you in a minute. So let's look at this question of sugar and metabolic disease that Credit Suisse has so aptly pointed out. Over here we have a histogram of the NHANES database in America. You know what that is, right? Nutritional Examination Survey. And this histogram depicts the percent of calories in the diet as added sugar. So it's control for calories because it's a percent. And the median of this histogram is at 18%. And this goes over 20 years, 1988 to 2006. The red line going through the center is the hazard risk ratio for heart disease death, dying of a heart attack for that same population over the same period of time. And the inflection point of that graph is 15%. So what does that mean? That means that more than half the U.S. population has an increased risk of dying of a heart attack because of their added sugar consumption, exclusive of calories. And if you happen to be out on the right end of that, you'll notice that the hazard risk ratio is 4. So if you're consuming 30 to 32% of your calories as sugar, which our teenagers are doing, you're going to fourfold more chance of dying of a heart attack. So if you think we have a health crisis now, wait till all the gurneys, okay, at Toronto General are filled with heart attack victims in their 40s. Okay, and let's see if you can get medical care. We've already basically said we're throwing those people out. You're going to have to throw them out too soon. This is from the EPIC Interact study. This is the Europe version of the NHANES, asking the question, do sugared sweetened beverages, SSBs, predict diabetes rates? And you'll notice the red box. So adjusted model plus EI, energy intake, so that's calories, plus BMI, that's obesity. So adjusted for calories and obesity, each sugared beverage consumed per day increases risk for death by 29%. And in America, we're not consuming one sugar beverage per day, we're consuming 2.5 on average. So take that number up to 68% increased risk of diabetes. Here are two meta-analyses. The top one for sugar beverages like soda, the bottom one for fruit juice. And you'll notice that when you adjust for adiposity, they do not cross one, they do not cross identity, which means that they're statistically significant. Fruit juice statistically significantly correlates over time with diabetes rates. But fruit juice is healthy. It's got vitamin C. Take a friggin' pill. The reason fruit is healthy is because it has fiber. Fruit juice doesn't. Everybody got that? So throw your smoothie machines away, people. This is a study that we did. My grad student was my dietitian, Luis Rodriguez. We took the NHANES adolescent database and determined what percent of their of people's calories adjusted for adiposity came from sugar in all their foods. And we divided them up into quintiles. The reference quintile is the first quintile at 30 grams per day of added sugar. And you can see as the quintiles go up, the risk for metabolic syndrome goes up tenfold in adolescence. We also looked at the Food and Agriculture Organization statistics database. So for the whole world, over a decade, 2000 to 2010, we looked at line items. We looked at total calories. We looked at fruits excluding wine, meats, oils, fiber-containing foods, dairy, and sugar, crops, and sweeteners as separate line items. Calories per person per day, per country, per year for a decade. We then melded that with the International Diabetes Federation statistics database for diabetes prevalence, country by country, year by year, for the same decade. And then we melded that with the World Bank Gross National Income database to control for the five confounders: poverty, urbanization, aging, physical activity, and obesity. To ask the question, what about the world's diet predicts diabetes? Answer, only sugar. Nothing else. Not total calories. Total calories were nothing. If any country had an extra 150 calories per person per day in their country, diabetes prevalence went up a total of 0.1%. Nothing. But if those 150 calories happened to be a can of soda instead, diabetes prevalence went up 11-fold, 1.1%. And again, in America, we're at 2.5 times that much, so take it up to 2.4%. Since we have a total diabetes prevalence of 9.3%, that means that 29% of all the diabetes in America today, this minute, are due to sugar and sugar alone. You want something to do? There's a good place to start. And now we have causation, true causation. Because what we did in this study, this was the first paper, now we have three. What we did in this study was we took 43 children out of our clinic at UCSF, our obesity clinic, with metabolic syndrome, Latino and African American, so poor kids, eating a crappy diet. And what we did was we figured out what they were eating at home, and we studied them on their home diet. And then, for the next 9 days, we catered their meals. No added sugar. We still gave them fruit, but no added sugar. And we didn't give them funky food. We gave them food right out of Safeway. Okay? We gave them processed food. We gave them crappy food. Okay? We took the pastries out. We put the bagels in. We took the sweetened yogurt out. We put the baked potato chips in. We took the chicken teriyaki out. We put the turkey hot dogs in. Okay? Crappy food. Not even fiber-containing food. Just no added sugar food. Now, if you're going to do that, you're going to reduce their calories by 350 to 400 calories per day, in which case they're going to lose weight, in which case then they'll get better, in which case then all your critics will say, well, of course they got better. They lost weight. So what we did was we gave them those calories back as starch. Got it? Calorie for calorie, the same. No change in weight. A fructose for glucose exchange to get the fructose out of the diet. But we increased the glucose. Got it? No increase in fiber. No increase in weight. No change in calories. 9 days. All right? That's the paradigm. Here's what we found. Every one of their fasting labs got better. You can see day 0, day 10. And if it's in red, it means it was significant. Blood pressure went down. Insulin sensitivity improved. Lactate. They had a lactate level. You're not supposed to have a lactate level at baseline. If you have a lactate level, either you ran a marathon, or you have cancer, or you have a mitochondrial disease. They had a lactate level, because indeed they did have a mitochondrial disease. It was called mitochondrial overload, which is what metabolic syndrome really is. And that got better. Everything got better, including their lipids. So if you look over here, A and B, you can see the tail, the red, that's the small dense LDL. That's the atherogenic particle that causes the heart disease. You'll notice on day 0, you can see it, and on day 10, it's gone. Just disappeared. Okay? And the changes in lipoprotein subfractions all improved. Triglycerides went down 46%, and ApoC3, one of the markers for heart attack, went down 49% with no change in calories and no change in weight. Here's their glucose tolerance tests. Notice their glucose went down by 8%, glucose area into the curve, and on the right, their insulin went down by 25%, and their beta cells started to rest so that their beta cells weren't exhausted, because that's what happens in type 2 diabetes. You get beta cell exhaustion. We then wanted to see what was going on in the liver. So we wanted to measure how fast the liver was turning sugar into fat. So we gave them C13-labeled acetate. We're doing fructose now. C13-labeled acetate, as you can see in the middle there. And it gets incorporated into palmitate, fatty acid, which you can then measure coming out in the blood. And here's what happened to their fat-making capability. It got cut in half over the course of the 10 days with no change in calories, no change in weight. And here's what happened to their liver fat depots. Notice in green, the sub-Q fat didn't change. because they didn't lose weight. So their sub-Q fat stayed the same. Their visceral fat, big belly fat, went down 7%, and their liver fat went down 22% in 10 days with no change in calories and no change in weight. And the reason is because fructose is the primary driver of that liver fat, and we now have the data to show that that is true. And here's what happens. Basically, when you're adding fructose, you're basically making lots of triglycerides. Some of it gets exported out as plasma serum triglyceride, which we measured, which went down, and some of it gets stuck in the liver. When you take the fructose out, the liver fat goes down, the de novo lipogenesis, the new fat making goes down, the VLDL goes down, the visceral fat went down, the liver fat went down, and their metabolic status improved. We made them better on the same number of calories. That's causation. Intervention, causation. So we have the data for four diseases. Sugar, causative for four diseases. Diabetes, heart disease, fatty liver disease, and tooth decay. We have associative, indirect data for sugar and cancer and sugar and dementia, but we don't have direct data yet. We don't have causative data. We know that sugar causes insulin resistance. We know insulin resistance causes cancer and dementia. We just don't know that sugar causes those things directly, or is it just mediated through insulin? We don't know that yet. We're working on it. And we now know, as I mentioned before, that this is the whole thing, the whole fat thing, was a big lie. And the reason we know it is because my colleagues at UCSF published this paper in JAMA Internal Medicine. I'm just going to read you the one line here, which New England Journal of Medicine, 1965, which singled out fat and cholesterol as the dietary causes of coronary heart disease and downplayed the evidence that sucrose consumption was also a risk factor. The Sugar Research Foundation set the review's objective, contributed articles for inclusion, and received drafts. The Sugar Research Foundation's funding was not disclosed. The Sugar Foundation put their thumb on the scale to tell us that fat was the bad guy and sugar was exonerated. Back 40 years ago, and the Harvard School of Public Health transmitted this in the New England Journal of Medicine. And there are still people today who still believe this. It is my job, and it is Gary's job, to disavow that belief amongst all of you, because we have the data and we have the smoking gun. Now, the environment. Sugar good for the environment? What do you think? So the World Wildlife Federation published this report saying that soil erosion because of sugarcane planting is a huge problem. In fact, America is going to need four Central Valleys by the year 2050, and we will not even have one because of soil erosion. And sugar is a primary driver of soil erosion, not necessarily in the Central Valley, but in other places. Here is Lake Okeechobee in the Everglades, and wherever you see orange, light green, or dark yellow, that's sugar plantation. In fact, when Matthew came through, okay, they had to open the locks of Lake Okeechobee, and all of the contaminated water spilled out into the west coast of Florida, and it basically killed off all the wildlife on the west coast of Florida, Fort Myers, all the way down to Naples, because of this. This is Minnesota. Okay, this is what happened from 1929, the Depression, through till today. And you'll notice back in 1929, they used to grow a lot of things in Minnesota. And now they only grow corn and soy. Why? Commodities. That's why. Okay? Because corn gets turned into high fructose corn syrup. That's why. So here's corn planting in the United States. In the upper right is atrazine use in order to keep that corn from being eaten by the locusts. In the bottom right is the nitrate contamination, and you can see it all through the Missouri Valley and the Mississippi. And finally, my favorite, bottom left, the ratio of government payments to farm gross income. And finally, last one, cash flow. Start with companies. This is Gary's picture from the Mother Jones article of how our food dollars have been reallocated over the 30 years of this disaster, 82 to 2012. Meats down 10% because we were all told to go low fat. Fruits and vegetables, notice exactly the same, no change, no difference. Now, We're always told we don't eat enough fruits and vegetables, and that is true. We don't. But we never did. Ain't new. But we didn't have this problem then, but we sure as hell have it now, because it ain't about the fruits and the vegetables. So promoting the fruits and the vegetables, I mean, okay, but don't think somehow that that's somehow miraculously going to fix this problem, because it ain't, and it hasn't, and it won't. Grains and baked goods, up a percent, and that's important because that's glucose, and glucose means insulin, and insulin means weight gain, so that's part of the obesity equation. Dairy products, down 2.5%, because now we're all lactose intolerant. I know I am. And lastly, the big kahuna, processed foods and sweets, 11.6 up to 22.9%, a doubling in the span of 30 years. That's what changed, and that's where the action is, and that's where the data say the problem is. So we have the epidemiology, we have the mechanism, we have the results, we have the intervention, we have the smoking gun. What the hell more do you need? But the food industry is doing quite well. So here's the S&P 500 in blue. And here's the stock price for McDonald's, Coke, and Pepsi. And you'll notice there's the economic downturn of 2008 over there. And they weathered that very nicely. They're doing quite well, thank you, right? And here's Hormel, ConAgra, ADM, Procter & Gamble, Kraft, and ConAgra, all doing better than the S&P. Want to make money? Invest in a food company. But guess what? Now the word is out. So here's, more recently, the S&P against Tate & Lyle, Ilovo, and Sudzucker, three sugar companies, all of a sudden not doing so well. In fact, many sugar factories have closed. So here's the percent of GDP spent country by country. There we are, U.S., 7% GDP, lowest percent GDP spent on food, and of course we are the most obese nation. There's the U.K. at 9%, and there's Australia at 11%. Okay? Well, here's the problem. Here are medical costs going up over time. And when you look at hospital, physician, and pharma costs, they do not add up to total costs because the rest of it is going to care for type 2 diabetes. In fact, we spend more than they make. And let's talk about that. So remember the slide I showed you before? Now I'm going to overlay on this slide the percent of GDP in America spent on health care for the same period of time. Notice when we started with processed food, that's when the percent of GDP spent on healthcare started to rise. So let's do the math. The food industry in America grosses $1.46 trillion a year, of which $657 billion is gross total profit. Healthcare, however, costs $3.2 trillion, of which 75% is chronic metabolic disease, the disease and metabolic syndrome, and 75% of that would be preventable if we could go back to 1970 levels. That means 75% of 75% of $3.2 trillion, that's $1.8 trillion a year wasted. We spend triple what the food industry makes cleaning up their mess. That is unsustainable, and it is why Medicare is going broke. It's also why Social Security is going broke. So, Social Security, as you know, is a Ponzi scheme. Okay, the only difference between Social Security and Bernie Madoff is that with Bernie Madoff, okay, you had a chance of making some money before he went belly up. That's the difference. Okay, the healthy young people have to pay in so that the sick, infirm people at the top can take out. But what happens when the young people are not healthy? What if they're sick? What if they can't contribute because they're on disability? In fact, what if Social Security has to pay them? The entire foundation of the pyramid collapses. And that's why Social Security will be broke by the year 2026 as well. This is from Morgan Stanley, another international investment bank. Okay? And what did they say? This is the percent of economic growth on the y-axis against modeling the next 20 years. With a low sugar case in blue and a high sugar case in gold, which is where we are now. And you'll notice that the gold case by the year 2035 takes us to 0.0% economic growth. Now, who is that good for? Anybody? Is that even good for the food industry? Think about it. So Credit Suisse an international investment bank who've determined that fat was not the problem, also published this report called Sugar Consumption at a Crossroads. And this is what they said. We believe higher taxation on sugary food and drinks would be the best option to reduce sugar intake and help fund the fast-growing healthcare costs associated with type 2 diabetes and obesity. An international investment bank is calling for taxation. Now, how effed up is that? That's how big and bad this problem has gotten. And they get it. A bank gets it. But the doctors? In fact, we have modeled how much money and how many lives we could save if we could reduce sugar consumption by either 20%, which could be achievable with taxes, or by 50%, which would be achievable if we actually adhered to USDA guidelines. And you can see fatty liver disease, heart disease, type 2 diabetes, obesity, all better. In fact, the doctors know. The International Diabetes Federation went to the G20 in 2015 and told the G20 that they had to tax sugar to save lives and money. Mexico did it. And you know what? It worked. And it's still working. Now, it didn't work as well as they had predicted. So, of course, the food industry said, see, it didn't work, because they had predicted a 10% decline. They got a 6% decline. But it still worked, and it was durable because it lasted for 2 years, and it's going on now year number four. Berkeley did it, and here's the data on Berkeley. Notice, sugar-sweetened beverages down, water way up. And the thing is that the food industry actually knows this. They know. And who was the one who first knew it, of all people? Mars, the candy maker. M&M's, Milky Way, Snickers. Sugar is their stock in trade. And they came out with a statement that said that they supported the USDA's approach to no more than 10% of daily intake. And they also believed that it was time for all stakeholders, including industry, to engage in a constructive discussion that focuses on effective approaches to help consumers manage their intake of added sugars. A candy company gets it. And guess who gets it now? Coca-Cola. They themselves have now admitted a calorie is not a calorie. So, all you dietitians who are still doing math, I'm hunting you down. This is about science. This is not about math. It never was about the math. And if you're doing math, you're part of the problem, not part of the solution. Fix it. So, imagine the past 50 years have been this grand experiment. The hypothesis, processed food is better than real food. Let's look at the scorecard. Consumption, way up, no argument. Health and disease, a complete and utter disaster. In fact, if this had been a research protocol, it would have been stopped decades ago by the IRB because of the deaths. Environment, huge problem. Super weeds, Iowa. And cash flow to companies, good previously, not so good now. For consumers, short-term gain for long-term pain, because diabetes costs more than soda. And for society, 0.0% economic growth. Processed food is an experiment that failed. You are chefs. Food is medicine. That means that chefs are doctors. And you need to think of it that way, and you need to practice it that way. What are you feeding your clients? Because they'll keel over because of what you fed them, unless you're careful. There's only one answer: real food. Real food works. Real food has worked for millennia. It's only in this little experiment that things went awry. At UCSF, we put our money where our mouth is, and we have taken sugar beverages off campus, called the UCSF Healthy Beverage Initiative. We have a toolbox that can help any institution do the same, to get rid of sugar beverages. Remember, where did smoking disappear first? Hospitals. because we have to model good behavior for the patients. So we've gotten rid of sugar beverages. I advise you to do the same, and you can, and we can help you. Number two, proposal number two. Let's call type 2 diabetes what it is, processed food disease. Now that would be an educational moment, wouldn't it? You have processed food disease. Think maybe somebody might actually change what they did if you told them that? Yeah, because diabetes is an Egyptian word, means siphon. Nobody knows that, okay? I mean, you're in the bathroom peeing your brains out, siphon, you know. But like, people say, I got the sugar. They don't even understand what that means, because there are two definitions of sugar, right? Blood sugar and dietary sugar. And they are confused on purpose by the industry for their own purposes, because the food industry says you need sugar to live. No, you don't. You need a blood sugar to live. You don't need dietary sugar to live. So they say that on purpose to confabulate, to confuse, to obfuscate the truth. You have to understand the science to be able to call them on it. Proposal number three, let's get rid of subsidies. There's no economist on the planet who believes in subsidies anyway, because they distort the market. Let the market work. So let's roll back the subsidies for corn, wheat, soy, and sugar. And they say, well, food prices would go up. Well, you know what? The Giannini Foundation at UC Berkeley actually modeled what would happen to food prices if we got rid of all subsidies. And it turns out the only two things that would go up are sugar and corn. Perfect. Just what we want. Let's get rid of food subsidies. Proposal number four, a trust mark. We've developed a nonprofit to take this on called REAL, R-E-A-L, Responsible Epicurean and Agricultural Leadership. You see this on a package, see this in a restaurant, you know that this restaurant can't kill you. We have this now, we've rolled this out. The state of Tennessee has signed on. We're getting the state of Virginia. Could do it here in Canada. And finally, let's get sugar off the grass list, generally recognized as safe list, because sugar is not food. Sugar is a food additive, like alcohol. And it does the same diseases as alcohol, causes the same problems as alcohol, because alcohol is metabolized to fat in the liver, and sugar is metabolized to fat in the liver. Sugar is the alcohol of the child, and that is why children today get the diseases of alcohol without alcohol, because they are indistinguishable at the level of the mitochondria. You would never give your kid a can of Budweiser, but you don't think twice about giving him a can of Coke, and they're the same. So for more information, we have a website that is curated by UCSF called sugarscience.org. 8,000 clinical research articles vetted by 12 independent scientists who do not take money and distilled into 5 messages for the general public that they can use. Fed Up, a movie that told how we got to where we are today with our food supply. Sugar Coated, made here in Toronto by The Cutting Factory, a movie that tells why we got to where we are today. The corporate malfeasance, the fraud, the PR campaign, which Gary and I both appear in. I want to thank all of my colleagues at UCSF, at eatreal.org, our nonprofit that's doing this work to advocate for changes in the global food supply to support and promote real food to ameliorate childhood obesity and type 2 diabetes. Thank you so much.
And that was Robert Lustig, an endocrinologist who is speaking at the Center for Hospitality and Culinary Arts at George Brown College in Toronto, Ontario. And that talk happened in 2017 at an event called Ambition Nutrition 2017. Robert Lustig is a very well-known endocrinologist and research scientist who's been studying sugar and its negative impacts on people, added sugar that is, processed sugar, and he's featured in many documentaries like Sugar Coated and Fed Up, and you can find out more about him by going to his website, which is robertlustig.com. So that's Robert, R-O-B-E-R-T, Lustig, L-U-S-T-I-G.com. That's all the time we have left in the show today. Thanks for listening to Equilibrium, and have a great rest of the day. This is your host, Ryan Young, signing off.
University, I pull it up in Merkel B. Mama, how we filled up with bags of Hercules. Soon as I finish pissing, I put the seat down. Oh, my mama beat on, come on, damn, I'm retired. Only child, no siblings, no besties. I couldn't do nothing right like a lefty. Bought my mama first house with the jewel, man. Bought my mama second house with the club, man. Me and mama used to chop out the same house. Used to eat and go to sleep on the same couch. Me and mama got busted at the same time.
You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.
Thank you.